I don't know if that helps.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today in our House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development on this fine day, March 30th, 2015. The first bill up we have today is a public hearing on House Bill 3255, so I will open this hearing. And I will turn this over to our two esteemed colleagues, Representative Davis and Representative Hoyle. Thank you for being here. In any order that you like.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. It's a great pleasure to be here today to talk to you about bicycle safety on our Bike Ped Safety Bill Day. And Vice Chair Gorsuch, welcome. Can you see me?
We can see you, Representative Davis. We can see you. We need our sunglasses on today. Thank you very much.
Can you see him now?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify about House Bill 3255. As I've said before, my intent in dropping this bill and proposing it is to have a conversation, as we're having today, about bicycle safety and pedestrian safety. And I'm very excited to hear all the bills we're going to hear about today. We know that cycling is growing tremendously in the United States, and that's something that we should support. The latest data I could find from the National Transportation Administration as of July 2014 saying that between 2000 and 2012, the number of Americans traveling to work by bicycle increased from about 488,000 to almost 800,000. And certainly in Oregon, we have a great tradition, including embodied upon one of our license plates, of sharing the road and of encouraging cycling, both as a recreational activity, but also as a true alternative mode of transportation to and from work and for many other purposes. I myself work in downtown Portland. Although I don't cycle to work, share the road with many other cyclists. I think it's well documented the tens of thousands of people, including many of my coworkers, who create more room on the road, frankly, by cycling to work, who improve both their own physical fitness, but also the healthiness of our environment through that. So I bring this bill to you as a supporter of cyclists and examining where we're at in Oregon and the world with bicycle safety. And the fact is that because of the increasing number of cyclists on the road, which is a good thing, we are seeing increased fatalities from cycling and increased accidents. Now, that's part of a natural growth that we would expect. But what was interesting from the data that I've read from NTSB is that roughly half of cycling accidents and deaths occur after 4 p.m., so between the hours of 4 p.m. and midnight, which would indicate the evening commute for most people, twilight and darkness. And it got me to looking and to talking with some constituents and friends about cycling and cyclists, and that's where the original genesis for the idea of reflective clothing, and not just a reflective vest, but reflective strips, reflective clothing on cyclists, and whether or not that could, in fact, increase cycling safety. And there's some data to support that. There's at least, I think there's two separate studies done by the Queensland University of Technology, and there are four documents that we've placed on OLIS, talking about cycling safety, some of which I've cited with the NTSB data, the traffic safety data, and then two links and references to the studies from Queensland University of Technology. Both of them showing that, first, cyclists are not as visible at night as they perceive, and I think that's probably true of everybody. Those who are texting and driving think that they're better drivers than they actually are. Those who are driving in general, everybody rates themselves as better drivers than they are. And those who are cycling probably rate themselves as more visible than they are. Both of these studies indicate that. One of the studies also indicates that actually reflective clothing and reflective strips is an effective way to make yourself visible on the road. That being said, after some very thoughtful conversations from folks from the cycling community who came and visited me and said, we just see some elements to this that would not be workable, they proposed actually limiting the bill with a gut and stuff amendment, as you see the dash twos, which would change an existing requirement for bicycle equipment from the current requirement, which is that bicycles have a rear reflector visible from up to 600 feet to actually a rear light at night. And the bill refers, I think, to, I don't have the page that I thought I had, it refers to times of limited visibility. That is defined elsewhere in statute as between sundown and sunup. So it is defined as night elsewhere in statute. The bill would simply require a red light as opposed to a red reflector. And the reason that was proposed is simply because you wouldn't have to worry about having a particular piece of clothing on or going to work and forgetting a reflective strip, but it's a piece of equipment that could be on your bicycle at all times, activated at night. And the difference, I think, the reason I think this is a common sense alternative is that current law, which requires a rear reflector and a front light, the law does require a front light, does not help those who may be coming in from the side or at a great distance or in certain conditions of weather where headlights would not hit the reflector. So I bring this as a proposed common sense alternative to House Bill 3255. Welcome your questions and very much welcome the testimony that we will be having for the remainder of the day.
Thank you. Representative Coyle, it's so nice to have you here in our committee today.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. It's very nice to be here. My name is Val Hoyle. I represent West Eugene and Junction City. I also have the great honor to be a board member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And I appreciate the larger discussion that we're having today about safety of cyclists and pedestrians, and really appreciate my colleague, Representative Davis. We had a great conversation about really what is it going to take so that we can have less fatalities. It's very, very important as we look at transportation that we look at all modes of transportation. You know, what is the appropriate transportation? My husband commutes 18 miles a day on bike, but in Eugene and Springfield, we're very lucky that we have some great bike paths so he can get to work safely. However, as we just had a recent tragedy in Springfield where three children were killed crossing the street. And I know when my first session here, I worked on a bill with Bicycle Transportation Alliance and other people to make it safer to cross the road after a child in my district died crossing the road to go near a school where there wasn't a crosswalk. And I don't ever want to have to talk to another mother about what we could have done to save their child. I worked in the bicycle industry starting 30 years ago, and at that time we had a lot less safe access to the roads, and it wasn't as easy or safe to cycle or to walk. But now, as we think about what we're doing with transportation, I think we should look at integrating unifying Vision Zero policy that sets a clear goal of reaching zero fatalities and serious injuries. Now, I know that is an aspirational goal, but I can't think of a more important aspiration. Now, part of that is, as cyclists, and I consider myself a cyclist, even though I don't ride my bike here very much, but I am a cyclist, that I have to take responsibility for ensuring that I can be visible. But what I don't think we should be doing is coming in and saying it's just up to the cyclist. People who are driving do need to be aware. They need to be aware of pedestrians. They need to be aware of motorcycles. They need to be aware of cyclists on the road. And many dangerous driving behaviors can be prevented with simple street design changes. So when we're looking at our transportation packages, and this is what you do here, again, think about all modes of transportation, because if we can get people out of their cars, it's better, it's more healthy, it's better for our environment, and it is one of the things that we here in Oregon do better than anywhere else, whether it's Cycle Oregon and through, you know, many great parts of our state, or in our urban areas where we have fantastic access to commuting, or in our wine, you know, in the Willamette Valley. People come here to cycle, to mountain bike, to road bike, and ensuring that people can do that safely, I think that's a fantastic goal. So as you're looking at transportation policy and you're looking at transportation packages, please consider all forms of transportation. And that isn't just an urban issue. It is urban, it is rural, and it's a great thing to do. We also, if you didn't know, we have many, many cycling companies that are based right here in Oregon. So this is a cottage industry, whether it's high-end bicycles or wheels or bicycle trailers. This is something that people come here because this is a great place to live. It's a great place to recreate. And anything that we can do to ensure that people can do this more safely, I think that we should do. So I want to thank you for your efforts. And I'm here to support my colleague. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for bringing the bill. And I guess I was curious. I was trying to figure out exactly which bicycles wouldn't be required to have the light, and I was reading the bill, and it says, I think it says like all bicycles on the highway. Is that what this comes down to?
Chair McEwen and Representative Bentz, for instance, if you have a racing bike, you know, you may not, you know, and you're not driving at night, you may not want to put a light on a high-end racing bike or a mountain bike. Those are two examples I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, yes. I was just trying to think of what types of children's bicycles. A tricycle wouldn't have a light on it. I'm just trying to figure out which won't have these requirements. Like, would the mountain bikes be required to have this, or is this just road bikes?
Chair McEwen,
yes.
Representative Bentz, does this is in part of the vehicle code or the bike code relating to requirements for bicycles on a highway. So I would presume that as long as a mountain bike is not being used on a highway, it would not be required.
And a follow-up?
Yes, sir.
So on the two times I've been on Cycle Oregon, and soon to be a third, you would be insane not to have lights on both the front and the back of the bike. But I'm just wondering, that's because you're out on the highway a lot and you need the lights. But I'm just curious if this is so broad it captures folks that aren't going to be on highways except crossing them once in a while. So that's why that's what my questions are for, because I can certainly see somebody pedaling 100 yards or half a mile or something down a highway and then going off into the brush to ride off road. So that's my question. Do they need to have that light as they pedal up and down whatever mountains they're climbing? If the answer is yes, fine. I just want to make something of this, of your intent and what you're bringing.
Chair McEwen and Representative Bentz, I'm going to defer to the lawyer.
I think that's a very wise Representative Hoyle.
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, again, the statutory references to cyclists on a highway. So to the extent someone is riding on a highway, they would need to have this equipment. If they were on trails, they would not need to have it. If they were crossing a highway, I guess for that moment, the law would require them to have that.
Follow up?
Yes.
And I know that the two of you, probably not the lawyer, did have a background in running a bicycle retail operation at one time. And I'm just curious what this type of lighting that could be seen for 600 feet would cost.
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, you can get a decent rear light I haven't worked in the bike industry for about 8 or 9 years, but anywhere for $8 to $15, or if you want something really, really bright, for instance, my husband's lights, because he does commute every day, and sometimes when it's dark, his light, front and rear light, can run up to like $200 because it's as bright as a headlight. So it ranges from very inexpensive to ridiculously expensive, but the right price for the quality.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative
Chair McEwen,
if I
could have an opportunity, Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, my father-in-law, who went out and shopped this for me, said he found one for $6 at a large big box store.
Thank you. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question as it relates to the highway requirement. What happens if it's a cyclist who just is going back and forth to work, say, in downtown Portland, downtown Eugene, doesn't cross necessarily into the highway perspective, but is still in, you know, major traffic areas, but it's in a downtown situation, and it's still at night? Does that not apply?
Representative McEwen, Representative Hack, I believe, although I'd have to bring in legislative counsel, I believe highway is defined elsewhere in the code here as public streets.
Okay.
So I believe it would include paved public streets. That would be city streets, county roads, and highways. I would have to check with legislative counsel to find out if that's true, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hack. You asked my question, so I will
stand out. Yes, Representative Lively.
So thank you, Chair. So I want to just pursue a little bit more. So if that's the definition, I'm not doubting it probably is. I want to talk about, again, young people, very young people. I can tell you in my neighborhood, and I've done it with my grandchildren, you ride on the highways to teach the kids how, and they're riding on these pretty small bikes. And so my concern becomes not only are they required, but given the height of the bike, the place that the light may be placed on there, because many times they're going home in the evening from the school and it's too dark. So does it accomplish the same thing? Are they required to have it? Or?
Representative McEwen, Representative Lively, my presumption would be yes, they would be required to have it. Yeah, I mean, if the intent is safety, then the presumption that is that existing law and this change in the law would be required at all times at night.
And the section talks about parents being responsible if the equipment doesn't meet the standards. It does. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I have one minor question. I'm intrigued on line 17 where one word has been changed in this bill. And it says, it used to say a person shall, and now it says a person may not install or use any siren or whistle upon a bicycle. Why are we changing that?
Chair McEwen, that would be legislative counsel's regular cleanup of legislation that we see, where not requested by anybody, but inserted by them as a cleanup and a uniformity piece to all of our laws.
Thank you for the clarification. I was very concerned about sirens and whistles on bicycles. So thank you for that.
As well you should be.
Yes. 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 Thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to call up now Jonathan Manton, Deblin McKnight, and Matthew Troy. Thank you, representatives.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Representatives and Chair McEwen. My name is Jonathan Manton, here today testifying on behalf of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Our mission is to create healthy, sustainable communities by making bicycling safe, convenient, and accessible. And just wanted to echo the comments that have already been made by Representative Hoyle and Representative Vice Chair Davis and say thank you so much for doing this today and for having this conversation on bike safety. This is something that we have been hungry for, frankly, to have a conversation on this subject. And so I just want to express very excited gratitude for being able to do this today. And with the Dash 2 amendments, the BTA would get to a point of neutrality on the bill. The values that we're balancing here is that we want to be encouraging people to get on their bikes. And the more people that cycle, actually the safer it is because there's safety in numbers. And so we do have concerns when we propose bills that are creating offenses for law enforcement to step in a sense, creating hurdles for cycling. And so those proposals have been ones that we have tried to, mitigate and oppose in the past. And so as drafted, we would oppose the bill. But if we get to the Dash 2s where we're just talking about the light, that seems to be a common sense proposal. And what we're really hoping to do is use this as a springboard to have a much larger conversation about bike safety, which we get to have today. And so I just want to say thank you for that. I'm double booked. I'll be out of here after about half an hour or so. So if we get to it, I'll stick around for the rest of it. But other folks from the Bicycle Transportation Alliance are going to be here to talk about road safety and road design and infrastructure needs and some things that can really move the ball forward on bike safety. And so just want to say thank you, especially to Representative Davis and Chair McEwen for doing this today.
Thank you for being here, Jonathan. Yes, sir.
Well, we're here for the Senate Bill 533, SB. I don't know if you guys called us up prematurely or...
Well, I think we have you signed up for this bill. Is this inaccurate?
That was probably a mistake on my part. It's my first time here.
Oh, okay.
If you don't want to testify,
if you want to go ahead and stand down and go ahead and sign up on the Senate bill, we'll call you up at the appropriate time.
Terribly,
figured
that out pretty quickly.
Sorry.
That's okay. No problem. You get a pass.
Yeah. Thank you.
Of course. Then I believe that exhausts our witness list for this bill, and I'm going to go ahead and do that. Unless there's anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to House Bill 3255.
I have a question for him.
Oh.
See if he could get him back up here.
Jonathan, I'm sorry. Mr. Manton, you're not excused. Representative, I apologize. I was just rolling along.
He's trying to sneak out.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just curious, how many people already have lights?
Chairman McKeon and Representative Benz, that's a great question. I don't have that statistic for you, but I can certainly look into it and see if we can get an answer for you. Would you be, as a matter of percentage from like the BTA membership or?
Maybe a wild guess will do. I'm serious.
I would guess most. I mean, just as a person cruising around and, most of the folks that I see do have lights. And the current law, as I understand it, says light on the back seat or reflective gear to 600 feet. And I think you could interpret that to say that if it was a reflective fender, it would have to be visible by 600 feet. That'd be a pretty good reflector, depending on how you interpret that.
So I know on the Cycle Oregon exercise, you're required to have them actually in front and back, I think. But I honestly don't know about the front. But as the demographic ages, we have more and more people out there driving that maybe can't see quite as well as they once did. You'd think it would be extremely advisable to have the biggest light you could possibly afford on the back of your bike. But is that a common perception by those who are riding? Or I'm just curious what people are thinking when it comes to these lights.
Chair McKeon and Representative Benz, it's a really good question. And I think that there's been internally within the Bicycle Transportation Alliance some back and forth about, where to be on that proposal, ultimately getting to a point of neutral. Of course, we want to encourage people to have lights. We want to encourage people to wear helmets. We want to encourage people to be as safe as possible in every way, obeying the law. Where it gets to be a little tricky is where you cross that line of, when you have government telling people to, mandating things that might come across as crossing that line of setting up an obstacle to cycling. And so that's the little bit of a tricky balance, but certainly want to encourage everyone to have a bright light on the front and the back.
Thank you.
Sure. Representative Benz, do you have a light on the back of your bike?
I do.
Thank you. I believe we are.
It's a big fog.
Do you have another question?
I don't, but right. Mr. Chair, I think there may be someone else up there who we just can't see.
Because he's not wearing a vest.
Because they're not wearing a vest.
That's right.
Yeah, so maybe
thank you, Mr.
Mann.
On that note, unless there's anyone else who would like to speak to this bill in the audience today, I will close the hearing on House Bill 3255. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 533. And Mr. Brennan, I neglected to have you tee up the last bill, but I'm happy to have you tee up this bill.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. No problem at all. Senate Bill 533 comes to this committee after moving through the Senate with a floor vote of 29-0. It permits motorcycle operators and bicycle operators to proceed at a stoplight under certain conditions when a vehicle detection device fails to detect the presence of the motorcycle or bicycle. This measure has no fiscal revenue impact. There are no amendments before the committee. And that's where I'm at, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. I believe we have a list coming. Okay, we have a robust list. So what I think I would like to do is call up panels of three. And I will start out with Larry Walker, Ken Ray, and Paula Leslie, please.
Bracket room, let's go first.
And you certainly may choose the order in which you testify.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative, all of you representatives.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for allowing us to bring this bill forward and let it be heard. For the record, my name is Paula Leslie, Director of Bike Pack of Oregon. Bike Pack of Oregon represents a Bait of Oregon and all of Oregon's motorcycle riders. We attend and participate with Oregon's transportation safety advisors to help us further our mission statement promoting motorcycle safety, awareness, education, and liberty through legislative action. Bike Pack is here in support of Senate Bill 533, which allows a motorcycle rider to proceed at a red light under certain conditions. While working proactively to safely share the road with other modes of traffic, Bike Pack of Oregon has identified this dead red light issue as a particularly concerning issue among motorcycle riders. And now, if I may, Chair McEwen and one of the vice chairs, you should have a wrist exerciser there. If you wouldn't mind just holding that closed for as long as you can and just kind of keeping track how long you can keep that closed.
Ma'am, I'm going to make note that I've had hand surgery on both hands, and my orthopedic surgeon is not going to probably appreciate that.
Okay, so
I'm going to hand it off to the vice chair.
Good idea. I would support that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. 1, 2, 3, go.
So the idea behind this is it's in your left hand. This resembles your clutch. This is something that you have to keep closed
in your right hand
tightly while you're stopped at a light in order to keep your motorcycle from moving forward. So the dead red lights are those sensor-activated traffic lights that fail to sense the presence of a vehicle and remain red while the other lights in the intersection continue to cycle. After one full cycle of lights at the intersection, the motorcycle rider may proceed with caution.
Thank you.
The problem is that many of those light-activated sensors placed on the road do not work for motorcyclists and other lightweight vehicles. This is a problem in most small towns and rural areas. The benefits to this bill would be to put the rider in charge of their own safety, which we think is best. We wouldn't have to sit and wait at a light in order for a car to come up behind us and activate the light, putting us in a potential rear-end collision scenario. Riders would not be ticketed if they stop, wait for a reasonable amount of time, and proceed with care. Bike Pack of Oregon encourages riders to report malfunctioning lights as they encounter them. We have a letter on our Bike Pack of Oregon website that you can click on. It's a pre-written letter that they can send to their Public Works Department to report those as they...
Did you know...
I'm sorry.
Was someone timing? How many minutes was that?
It was a while.
It was a while.
Madam Chair.
Not long enough.
Members of the committee, I would like to say
you
that
them
you
out.
Just ran a red light.
Oh. There you go. Thank you.
You're welcome. In addition, I would like to say we've got 14 other states that have enacted a similar bill. You can find those on the back side of your sheet. They're a little bit different. Rules that they require. Some require you to wait 2 minutes. Some of them require you to wait a reasonable amount of time. And with that, I would encourage any kind of questions or comments you might have.
Great, thank you. If anyone else on the committee would like to be timed, I'm sure you would allow us to hold on to those for just a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Thank you for your testimony. Gentlemen.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Ray. I live in Clackamas, Oregon. And within a few weeks, I will be a quinquagenarian, which means I have been riding motorcycles for over 30 years, mostly on the road. So this is one of those things that people, if you don't ride, it may not even occur to you that this is an issue. But those of us who ride on two-wheel, whether it's motorized or not, many of us can tell story after story of having to wait at a light, particularly left turn lanes. And this is where the genesis of this has come from. I've personally, the left turn I must take on Valley View to get to my house, I have had to wait not only on a motorcycle, but I've had it go on even on my car. It's a special problem because it's the photo ones instead of the ones that have the induction coils in the pavement. It uses photo recognition or camera recognition that something's in the lane. When the sun is behind me, it's getting pretty close to sunset, and that sun is shining right into that camera, it has a particular difficulty in picking up anything in that left turn lane, my caravan and my motorcycle. So although this wouldn't help me in my regular vehicle, on my motorcycle, this bill would make a big difference. I think that you might find that this bill is not revolutionary. This is an evolutionary bill. We already allow left turns on red going onto one-way streets in Oregon. That's been in statute for a good number of years. Although that's not exactly the same as having to consider your left turn across what is designated as oncoming traffic lanes. Nonetheless, it's something that's already in establishment in Oregon statute. Secondly, Many of you have probably already run across that they're reprogramming many of our left turn lanes to have the blinking yellow, thereby putting the road user and saying you are responsible enough to determine if you feel it's safe to go. And motorcyclists, if we had every traffic signal that was a left turn in the state of Oregon had that feature, this bill would not be necessary. But that will take a long time, if ever, and in the meantime, it is an issue that has been dealt with for some time, and as has been mentioned, many other states, including our neighbors in Washington and Idaho, Idaho has had their bill since, had changed their law in 2000, and I contacted some friends of mine in Idaho to find out if there's been any issues, any studies, anything that indicated that this is a particular change to the negative for safety. I contacted many other friends from many other states, part of a nationwide group of riders that I communicate with on email, and not a single state had anything that ever indicated that it was an issue when they had passed the law. They thought it would, just like many places thought when they allowed right turns on red it would become a big issue, but it isn't, because the vast majority of people are going to be safe. And this bill recognizes that, and I ask you to support it.
Sir, can you give me a sense? There are 16 states that have passed some iteration of this. How long have states been adopting this? What was the first state? How many years ago?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is something that started, and I can't recall which state was first, but I know it began over 20 years ago.
Okay, so this is not a new iteration. This has been coming for quite a while.
It is evolutionary, as I have said.
All right, sir, thank you. Yes, sir, welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill and allowing me, especially being from across the river from Washington State, to come down and testify. And the reason why I'm here is...
And your name, sir?
My apologies, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I'm Larry Walker with the Washington Road Riders Association.
Thank you.
And we passed this law last year, finally, after 12 years of hearings, which were very painful. A lot of the things we heard during committees, of course, and during conversations during interim was that, oh my gosh, we are all going to drive out in front of traffic and kill ourselves. And just rest assured, motorcyclists have a vested interest in staying alive. So we're not going to do this.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
WashDOT has asked me, please don't go kill myself on their roads, and I'm sure ODOT would appreciate that. This is really nothing more than like pulling out of a strip mall into a flow of traffic. It's probably actually a safer operation because at least it's at an intersection where people are expecting something to happen. When it's at, you know, coming out of strip malls, things of that nature, they're not. Motorcycles still aren't getting squashed there. One of the other issues is a lot of times if people talk about, well, you could just get somebody to pull up behind you in the lane and then allow traffic to move. That's really nice during dense traffic times. However, I live in a rural area of Washington State up in Kitsap County. And there's a lot of areas to where we have a traffic signal, but we don't have high traffic. I go to work at about 5 o'clock in the morning. Not a lot of people do that. So I can't wait for somebody to trigger that, which also, by the way, brings up one other thing. You're probably going to hear some conversation about we should just have a reporting mechanism so that we can report the traffic light, which would be fine during working hours, I guess, if you could use your cell phone to call from an intersection and traffic safety could then come out and fix the light. They can't. So that would be kind of counterintuitive for a short-term fix. Great for a long-term fix, and I highly recommend. But part of my other credentials is I sit on the Motorcycle Safety and Education Advisory Board for the state of Washington, and I also sit on the Target Zero Coalition Committee. And so I would have heard, trust me, Washington Traffic Safety Commission would take great delight in calling me up to say, Larry, you were wrong. There's accidents happening now. And I have not gotten those phone calls. So I know it's proving a negative, which is very difficult, but there's no data. And we implemented this in July of last summer, which, of course, anybody in the Pacific Northwest knows that's the official beginning of riding season because we had the 4th of July, the monsoons quit, and then everybody goes out and rides. So I thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you. And thank you very much for being here to testify today. I'm interested in the idea of waiting so long to make a left turn, whether or not there's a safety concern, frankly, in having to sit there. I've heard from both cyclists and motorcyclists that there's significant concern with having to wait there and being a standing target, so to speak. Is that true? What do you think of that assertion?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, I'll answer that. Absolutely. It's very scary sitting in a left turn lane, being right there all bare and uncovered with just your taillight there after dark, because they may not see you. I have actually been hit from behind slowing down for a railroad crossing many, many years ago, and they thought that bright red light in front of them was a railroad flare.
Yes, Madam Chair, as a follow-up on that, I had a similar situation to what you're mentioning just a few months ago at that, what I just mentioned about that right at sunset as the sun and one of our times of sun actually in the month of February. But it was quite harrowing in that I'm in my left turn lane, and in where I live and turning off of Sunnyside Road in Clackamas, the prevailing traffic right there at that intersection is somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 45 miles an hour, and I'm feet away. And motorcyclists, one of the joys of motorcycling is you're being in the environment and can smell the air, but you're also vulnerable, so you notice that particularly when traffic is coming close to you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you very much.
I would like to call up now, let's see. I may get this wrong. Robert Reichenberg? Was I close?
Very good, ma'am.
All right, thank you. And Deblin McKnight and Matthew Troy, please.
The right bill.
And now I think we've got the right bill for you. No harm, no foul. We appreciate you being here to testify, and please, in any order you choose again.
Well, I'll start out, Chairman Sheehan, members of the committee. I'm Bob Reichenberg from Jefferson, Oregon, and I'm here as chairman of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. The committee's voted to oppose this legislation. One reason is that the inductive loop traffic sensors that this legislation addresses are adjustable. They can be adjusted to detect both motorcycles and bicycles. And the Governor's Advisory Committee would prefer that riders take the responsibility to notify proper authorities about the need to adjust problem sensors rather than seeking permission to run red lights. An additional concern is beginning riders who may have little experience in judging speed and distance of other vehicles. And even experienced riders, as I'm a good example, can make terrible mistakes. And we fear that inexperience and peer pressure combined with the perceived right to run a red light could be fatal for new riders, both on bicycles and motorcycles. That's a very short testimony, but I'm prepared to answer your questions.
Sir, I think you've made your point very well. Thank you. And I think we'll finish the panel, and then we'll open it up to questions. Thank you for being here.
Of course. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the members of the committee. My name is Deblin McKnight, and I'm here with my business partner, Matthew Troy, and we represent Greenlight Technology, Inc. So we are here against Senate Bill 533. And we have put in front of you some of our paperwork or speech that we wrote up, which I'm not necessarily going to read.
Thank you.
In addition, we have given you some samples of our products that, as this gentleman to my right, I'm so nervous, I'm sorry.
You're doing just fine. We're actually quite a friendly crowd here.
Yeah. Thank you. The inductive loops in the road are adjustable, and there's a very common misconception that I'm sure all the riders in this room are familiar with, that the inductive loops aren't actually based on weight. They're based on magnetic force, so that inductive loop can be triggered if your car has enough metal on it or if you interrupt the magnetic force. There's many different examples that I could continue to tell you. It just interrupts the signal, basically. So you can change it so that it detects a wedding ring when you walk across it. The product that we have in front of you is a high-power neodymium boron ion ore magnet that you put on the underside of your motorcycle or bicycle, and when you travel over the inductive loop in the road, it triggers the signal in the loop and makes it a conductive loop to tell the light that you're there. In some instances, this won't work. There are lights that are just, you know, a Humvee wouldn't set it off, but this is a product that would negate the purpose of Senate Bill 533 having to continue through to the House of Representatives. We're here for motorcycle safety and awareness, and this product can help achieve that goal.
Okay. Thank you.
And,
yes, sir.
And as an owner, I
And your name, please, sir, for the
Matthew
record.
Troy, Senator Chair and committee. I've been writing my whole life, and I've been using this product for, I mean, this, we've been in business for 2.5 years. We've sold thousands of these things. We've had reviews. The product works. It's been, we were actually talking about when we started this a couple of years ago, coming down here and educating and informing everybody that there's a product that exists that solves this problem, but I'm kind of kicking myself now for not doing that. All we've done is created a website and sold some online, and we have you know, some distributors that just continuously rebuy our product, and we just go through these wholesale avenues, and it's not a very big company. But now that we saw this on the news, that this was about to get passed, we thought we have a responsibility to come forth and inform everybody about this. You know, it only takes one. You know, I've been riding bikes my whole life, and you know, I've had some dangerous spots where I've had to try to run the light, and because I've been sitting there for so long. And then when Debbie came along and we got this patent for this product and stuck it on my bike, it was just like, man, I can't believe I've been doing this for this many years. And so it's just, it makes the whole thing moot. I really would say that it takes about 2 minutes. You see in our, we put something together explaining it. It goes on the bottom underneath carriage of your bicycle or bike. You actually don't even need a vehicle, to be honest with you. We've tested this where you just walk over the loop and it'll actually trigger the light. So if you're a pedestrian or something, and
if you want to turn left while you're walking.
Yeah,
on the
yeah. Roads. So it's that powerful. It's a fundamental patent that we have, that any magnet used to trigger this loop falls under this patent, the two patent numbers that we have. We have a utility and a fundamental patent. So, you know, it's a $29 product to save a life. It only takes one, I mean, one idiot that thinks they're safe, runs it. There's a guy speeding through the intersection, happens to be going 30 miles over the speed limit, and then bam, you know, it's just that one life. So I would just tell everybody in here that, you know, now that everyone's aware of it, please give it proper consideration, because, you know, any accidents or, you know, injuries as a result of passing a bill like this, now that we know, everyone knows that this exists, I mean, it falls on the conscience of everybody in here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here to talk to us about it today.
Yeah, thank you.
I believe we have some questions from the panel. So,
sure.
Representative McLean.
Well, this is main primarily just for motorcycles, not cars, but motorcycles.
It can go on any. So smart cars sometimes don't have enough metal to trigger it too. So you can put it on any vehicle. So a bicycle, people, we've sold thousands of these to people just with bicycles. So motorcycles mostly, because obviously most of them riding in the street. So yeah.
But this okay. That's fine. I had a second question, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Okay. To you, sir, you're on a safety committee. Has your safety committee ever done a report like the one that we asked the previous panel on, if there were any issues in states that have actually passed a law like this? Have you guys done anything that has looked at this issue for people who have actually used it? You know?
Madam Chair, Representing McLean, we have not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the cost of that device again?
Madam Chair and Representative Gorsuch, the retail price is anywhere from $24.99 to $29.99, depending on if you're on Amazon or a personal website.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Seeing no more questions, thank you so much. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Mr. Brennan has a question.
Just for clarification, the term that you're using, which is can trigger the light, that's triggering the loop that will get the turn signal into the cycle. You're not actually, the device isn't actually switching the signal itself.
It's no, simply it's not a MERT device. It treats it just like you're an actual vehicle where it senses it. It solves the problem, guys, of this bill. It makes it a moot point, because as people pull up, motorcyclists, everybody in here that's riding motorcycles today should probably buy one before they leave. I mean, it's $29. I mean, we're not trying to sell and make a buck. In fact, it says in our proposal, our solution is public service announcements like safety belts, wear your helmet, put on one of these things so you don't have to run a red light.
I think Representative McLean has another question.
Okay, now I have another question.
Yes, ma'am.
So that's the old technology is what's in the ground. It, you know, what's
that's your loop that you're completing. But what about new technology?
I talked to the head of ODOT about that, and they said that they do have some laser technologies and things like that that are going to start out, but it's going to take years and years for right now. What is it, 90% of the...
85% of the United States currently has the infrastructure of the inductive loop system, and it's currently more cost-effective to maintain the loop system versus installing the new laser detection systems. And the new laser detection systems are wonderful. They work pretty well. They recognize most vehicles, whether that's a motorcyclist or a bicycle, approaching the light. But just in terms of infrastructure costs, it's more cost-effective for many of the programs to do the inductive loop and just to maintain the ones that are already being utilized. And mostly in new development, you see that laser technology.
One more.
Yes, follow up. What scares me about this technology that you're talking about is just the fact that it sounds like it's encouraging people to change lights or to be...
It's 100% passive. So it would just be as if you were in your car and approaching the light instead. I understand I'm not saying Madam Chair and Representative, and I apologize. But it's not encouraging it. It's completely passive, so it doesn't take any power or anything else. It's you just put it on your motorcycle, and it treats your motorcycle like it was a minivan or a Subaru.
So, Ms. McKnight, just to clarify, because I think we have a little bit of confusion, this is not like somebody's hacking into the system to turn the light green.
Correct. It's not a mert changer, which is what an
ambulance
is.
What it does is it does the same thing as a vehicle of a normal
exactly
weight and
right
size coming across that would trigger it and put it in the same order as any other vehicle, but it does not hack into the system and change the light.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
It makes the bill moot. I mean, it solves the problem. I mean, you're pulling up with your motorcycle, and you're no longer having to sit. I mean, I did it for years, and then I just popped. I actually have it on my bicycle as well. So, again, it would need a public service announcement to make people aware of this. Or one suggestion we have written in here is that when you go to get your motorcycle endorsement, make these available. We would even work something out where we have very thin margins on it and make sure that there's enough available for everybody to have accessibility to it. So,
thank you so much. Yeah. Any other questions for this panel? All right. We have quite a few people who want to testify behind you, so thank you so much
for
being here today.
Thank you.
I would like to call up now, I believe Jonathan Manton bugged out to a... Oh, see, oh, there you're back. Thank you, Mr. Manton. Mr. Slater and Mr. Mason.
Thank you very much again,
Madam Chair. I'm
sorry,
I didn't see you come back in.
No, that's okay. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Manton, again, with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And we support this bill. I'll just very quickly point out the safety concern that we see as a cyclist in this situation. When you come up on the so-called dead red light, oftentimes you'll be sitting there, and you're waiting for the light to change. It doesn't. And you might have a motorist behind you that's getting irritated, upset, and you know, kind of threatening to be a little aggressive, that's stuck behind the bicyclist. And so the safety concern that we're trying, the reason why we support this is because we think it actually makes it safer, given light cycles through. You have to sit there and wait for the cycle through, and then you can go ahead and proceed in order to, as a courtesy and safety mechanism, because of the people behind you.
Thank you for coming back. Yes, sir. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Mason. I am a member of Bike Pack. I would like to just say something very quickly to Representative Davis. My biggest fear is that sitting still, when you're looking in that mirror and you're in the left-hand lane especially, and the cars are coming up beside mm-hmm. you at normal speed, say 35, 45 miles an hour, they're texting, they're drifting. It is my biggest fear in 35 years of riding when I wasn't trying to grow the world's coolest chrome goatee during that time. I've been riding 35 years, and that is my biggest fear, you know, is that, and that has to do with this bill. The fact remains that there are electronic traffic control devices that will fail. No matter what you put on them, no matter what it is that you try to do, there will be times. What do we do when we're sitting at that, especially again, the left turn? When it doesn't change, you're going to see a motorcycle rider start doing this. And he's rolling his bike backwards or her bike backwards, and we're looking for this diamond shape or a line shape that is cut in the pavement, indicating that magnetic sensor is underneath the pavement. Riders who have been riding all their life will tell you they've done this hundreds and hundreds of times. When I pull up to a light, I specifically try to pull up directly over that diamond so that I don't later have to start jockeying my bike around. Our training teaches us that our most important defense mechanism is being aware of the environment around us when we're on the bike, because you have to be able to move quickly and think quickly, because guess what? You're going to lose in the event of a collision if you're on a motorcycle or bicycle. When we're looking for that diamond and we're moving around, we're no longer looking for that car in our rearview mirror. We're no longer looking at the light. We're looking down. We're moving things around. You're taking your mind off of that most important thing that a rider can have is situational awareness. Those will fail. Now, when they do, what can we do now? We can either proceed, period. We can make a right-hand turn if we're stopped at a light and there's a right-hand turn. You can go take a right, go down a ways, circle back, and figure out a way to get back on track to where you were going. Or if we're in the left-hand lane, again, worst-case scenario, we have to back up and move into that right-hand lane and then either make the right or wait and see if that one changes for us. Okay, none of these scenarios are good for us. And in my years of riding, I can tell you that there's been more than one occasion while I was doing the jockeying around in that lane, and looking up, I would see a police officer who might have been sitting in a 7-Eleven across the street watching that light for people running it, who was watching me. And finally, I'll give him the salute like this. More than one occasion, I see the hand come out of the top of the car and go like that, because there's nobody coming the other direction. Law enforcement has waved me forward to go through that light before. That's what Senate Bill 533 is about. It is not it's not a free card so that motorcycle riders or bicycle riders can go blowing through lights, much to the chagrin of the Oregonian, I'm sure, who wrote it up that way when it passed through the Senate, that all of a sudden we're going to be blowing through red lights everywhere. That's not what it is. Senate Bill 533 is just an exception after you've taken appropriate, extraordinary measures to try to trigger that signal, and you as a licensed and trained rider, only when totally clear and prudent, can make that turn, as if turning out of that strip mall, as was mentioned earlier. I thank you for hearing Senate Bill 533, and I'm open for any questions now or at the end of the panel.
Thank you. I think we'll hear the panel first, but thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christopher Slater. I'm a motorcyclist and an attorney who represents injured motorcyclists. So I'm here to give my support for Senate Bill 533. What we have here today is a rare instance, I'm sure you're aware, of an actual problem that's looking for a solution. And the problem, as you've all well heard by now, is that a lot of sensor-operated traffic control devices in the state of Oregon do not detect the presence of motorcycles or bicycles. And whether they're malfunctioning or miscalibrated, the truth remains the same for the rider who is facing a situation where the signal does not recognize them. And this happens with a lot of different traffic signals, by the way. It happens on metered freeway entrances as well. So under the current law, riders and bicyclists are forced to either choose between putting themselves in an unsafe circumstance or violating the law. And what they typically will do, riders are doing this today, is they're going to violate the law. And I had submitted for you testimony from a Sam Dixon, I believe it's in the record, that he actually had to go to court. He was able to get the judge to dismiss the ticket. I've heard other stories from other riders where they were not so successful. But the point is, your constituents are having to go down to court and having to take a day off work, having to appear, having to defend themselves from doing what's basically a common sense response to a problem. Now, with all respect to the prior panel, the solution is not to have over 250,000 motorcyclists buy an individual device that may mitigate some of these lights. I don't know what the number of bicyclists are in the state of Oregon, but I'm guessing it's more than 250,000. This is not DOT-mandated equipment. It's not original manufacturer equipment. And I think the notion of having private citizens having to buy a device because traffic design is not sufficient is probably not the answer. So what you have now is you have a situation where and I had another gentleman, and I don't unfortunately think his testimony was submitted, but he was actually rear-ended at a meter, because what happens is it'll cycle to the next car, and then you have a line of cars behind you, and they think you're going to go. They're not even looking for the light, and he got rear-ended right at the light. So And I agree with Bike Pack's position. This is not a green card for bicyclists and motorcyclists to run red lights. And if the governor's advisory committee is correct, that at least in their submission to the Senate committee, that the technology is evolving and this will be improved, then it won't be necessary. So this could be viewed as a temporary measure until the technology is able to come up to terms and safe standards so that bicyclists and motorcycles are recognized by these devices. Then, and only then, I think, would the law be moot, because it wouldn't be necessary. So I think what we have is a very common sense solution to a real problem. And California, Washington, and 14 other states, Idaho, 13 other states, have all passed these laws already. It's a common sense solution, and I don't think there's any revenue impact. So,
thank you. Gentlemen, do you know if any of the 14, it looks like 16 total states have passed this law, have rescinded this law? Anybody passed it and regretted it?
I'm not aware. Well, I can't speak to regret, Madam Chair, members of the committee, but I don't believe it's ever been rescinded.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We have one more panel to call up. Is it Garrett's? Gartz? Steve? Team Oregon? Welcome. Amy Joyce and Sean Severson. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you. Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Garrett. I'm the director of the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Program. I've submitted to you written testimony. I won't read from that. Just wanted to share with you my concerns. You've heard the safety concerns of motorcyclists waiting at these lights to trigger the lights, and that does happen from time to time. A call to the local jurisdictions, what we recommend from Team Oregon, so that the jurisdiction that's responsible for that roadway understands that light's not functioning properly for motorcycles. We include in our riding materials for the rider training that we provide information on where to position your motorcycle over the loop sensors so that it'll detect motorcycles. Our concern, why we oppose this, is for new riders, and particularly riders in groups, because if a lead rider goes out, it's our experience that groups like to stay together. And if a lead rider goes out against a red light, the rest of the group will typically follow. It's been our experience is that's what's happened, and that's just the concern that we have with kind of a group moving through that as opposed to one rider at a time. That's my major concern.
Thank you very much. Ms. Joyce, welcome.
Thank you, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and today specifically representing our Transportation Safety Division, submitted a little bit of written testimony, and a number of these points have already been covered by other presenters. But, you know, primarily ODOT has a safety concern about this bill. You know, kind of the fundamental point of traffic engineering and rules of the road at a fundamental level is to keep people out of the same space at the same time. So for that purpose, the sort of behaviors of vehicles need to be fairly predictable. We need to predict what other people are going to do. And that's a good way to drive defensively and stay out of accidents. So allowing this sort of behavior takes away from some of the predictability for motorcyclists and the people encountering them. We've got a problem, too, with the language in the bill about waiting for one full cycle. There's really no definition of that. And, you know, at anything more complex than just a standard, you know, crossing intersection where you've got left turns, perhaps a right turn arrow, different things going on. Cycles don't necessarily happen in a chronological order the same way every time. So a person could feel that they were skipped because it didn't happen when they thought it would happen. And in fact, it's just the normal course based on who showed up and the volumes of traffic at that intersection. So there's risk there. The second part of the bill language that gives us a bit of pause is the confusion where it allows a motorcycle to go through a red bicycle signal. The confusing part there is motorcycles aren't required to obey a red bicycle signal at all. So does it now impart a duty to stop for that red bicycle signal? So it's adding to confusion, some of this language in the bill. Another point is attached to your testimony are a couple of examples of vehicles, newish kinds of vehicles that are on the road today that don't look like a traditional two-wheel motorcycle. But technically they are. They've got three wheels and in some respects look a lot more like a passenger motor vehicle than they do like a motorcycle. And those vehicles are covered by this bill. Again, the expectation of other drivers around you is that everybody's going to stop for the red light. And when that isn't happening, especially for these larger vehicles, again, adding to the confusion. So those are the problems. What's the solution? The items that have been talked about here already. Team Oregon trains folks. It's in the motorcycle manual. How to position your bike over the loops to have that magnetic conduction. It's a common myth that it's about weight. It is not. It's about magnetic conduction. So that's really the solution. When I listened to the anecdote about the camera not seeing the vehicle, and I'm sure that happens. But the solution there is to contact the local jurisdiction and say there's a problem with your camera, the light shining on it. It's not picking up my minivan, my motorcycle, my bicycle. It's obviously an ongoing problem, so the jurisdiction needs to know and needs to take care of that. At ODOT, we prioritize failures of or miscalibrations of sensors as a top priority to be responded to within hours, regardless of the day of the week or the time of the day, because it's a potential safety concern. So that's the kind of level of concern we have about those things. So we just believe that there are safety problems and that there are existing solutions for this kind of problem that folks experience.
Thank you, Ms. Joyce. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Severson, and I'm a resident of Beaverton, Oregon. I've been there for about 10 years and previously lived in California where this is legal. I've been riding for about 30 years, when I previously rode in California where this is legal, I never witnessed any issues with practicing this. Several times, just like I have here, I've approached the left turn arrow, which never turned, and after a cycle, I proceeded cautiously through it, treated it like a stop sign. The city of Beaverton has also, in recent years, turned their red turn arrows into flashing yellow arrows, which as a previous person testified that this would be similar. And this is for all vehicles, motorcycles, cars, whatever. And I've noticed that this has been a great improvement to traffic. People understand that how this works. They understand this works like a stop sign. You approach it and you proceed through cautiously when you're able to. It's a safety hazard, and to sit there at a light for extended periods of time waiting for the light to turn. It's also a deterrent for traffic. Holds up traffic. You got people behind you honking, waiting, wondering why you're not moving. The other thing I like to bring to this is I'm also a controls engineer, and I understand how these things work. Inductance loops work with magnetism, and they pick up magnetic materials. I think most of us are familiar with the fact that aluminum and a lot of metals are not magnetic. Motorcycles and bicycles are for the most part constructed with materials like this, aluminum and exotic metals, composite materials that aren't detectable by magnetic loop sensors. So this is one of the it's not a weight issue. It's the construction of the motorcycles themselves, the aluminum composite materials. Having to add some device to your motorcycle to do this, I think, is not a solution. In that, not only does it pick up the material of your motorcycle, but where you are in the lane. If you're not exactly centered over the lane, it may not work as well. Not to mention having to add some foreign object to your motorcycle that at some point could fall off and lose it, or you're expecting people to install this device properly, and not to mention that it could cost motorcyclists in the state of Oregon millions and millions of dollars to install this, with hundreds of thousands of motorcyclists being registered in the state. And that's about all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we have some questions. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, Amy, is probably for you. So we talk about the predictability, and I can appreciate that. But I no longer ride motorcycles. I used to, but I'm a avid bicycle rider. And riding in the community of Eugene Springfield, I can tell you people are going through the red light mm-hmm. all the time after they've sat there. And so mm-hmm. what would be less predictable about putting the law that said at some point they can versus what they do now? Because I can tell you many, many times, including me, after I've sat at that light quite a while, I will turn against that light. And that's not predictable because there's nothing now that says we can, but they do it all the time, especially with bicycles. Let me go back to the bicycle. So I'm trying to understand which is less predictable. Is it less predictable to have a law that says they can after cycle versus we don't have a law now and they're doing it anyway?
Yeah, Chair McEwen and Representative Lively, thanks for the question. I would say that the earlier testimony about the more appropriate procedure would be to take that right turn and come around, or I'm familiar with folks, at the sidewalk hitting the pedestrian button to be able to turn the light. So those are a couple of options.
Follow-up?
Well, and I don't mean to bury a minute, but I'm going to go back to where the left turn lane. So I'll pick on Centennial, which is a very busy boulevard in Springfield back and forth. And so Centennial is four lanes going east and west, and the turn lane for left is out in the middle of those four lanes. And so there isn't a place where if I'm on my bicycle, I can turn right by pushing the button, because you're going to have to go across four lanes of traffic proceeding 45 miles an hour one direction or the other direction. So I'm trying, because not all situations lend themselves to that. But my issue still is predictability. That's all it is. It's just trying to understand what would be less predictable if the law says they could. To me, if I was in law enforcement and I knew the law said they could proceed after a cycle of the light, that would be more predictable than if I didn't know that they can proceed and guessing when they're going to proceed. I guess that's just the issue. It's not whether there are not other things they could do.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to go back to... Amy, I'm sorry, we're asking you these wonderfully difficult questions, but I want to go back to the passive left turn, which is the yellow flashing light. So, and in my community, one intersection has it, the next one doesn't, and it's ridiculous, really. So predictability is a question, but how is the passive left turn different from this proposal? I mean, in both cases, people are turning against traffic. So I guess I don't quite understand why the passive yellow makes sense, but the bikes and motorcycles turning doesn't make sense, if you could explain that to me.
Chair McEwen and Representative Gorsuch, I would say the difference is the actual difference between those two lights. The flashing yellow is a type of traffic control device that allows certain behaviors, mm-hmm. including going straight through. Actually, you don't even have to stop and then go. You can just cruise right through. A red light is a red light, and that means you stop and you stay stopped until it turns green. So that's the fundamental difference.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McLean.
Well, that was my first question, but my second question is the testimony that we've just heard talking about, you know, folks behind them getting anxious or wanting to get through and having a group. You were talking about the danger of a group and a whole group going through. I've seen that, too, with people behind going, what's going on with these guys? You know, what's happening here? I'm just trying to understand. It's not just predictability, but it's also the consequences that happen when people just end up stopping and not going or getting to go. I mean, have there been any reports or any studies done on that? Because, I mean, there's a lot of other possibilities there.
Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, I'm not aware of any studies that have been done on that matter, especially around motorcycles.
Okay. That's what, yeah,
Representative Benz. Answered my other one.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I was just assessing an interesting contrast between the light on the bicycle bill and then this one. It really is. But I appreciated Representative Lively's remark about the anticipation by others of whether people might be turning in front of them or not, and it just struck me that those who want to be safer would, of course, buy the device to fit under their bike, because then they would be the safest, because the light would change and they'd be protected from oncoming traffic. So the real issue, it seems to me, is if you want to be safe, you'll go buy that $29 device. You'll be safe. Mm-hmm. And everybody else will take their chances running a red light and get squashed by someone coming the other way. And it takes us right back to who we're going to force to buy something.
Yeah.
And so that's what we talked about earlier in the meeting when it came to the red lights on the back of bikes. Mm. I think it's a question of the volume of the activity. So anyway, I just was thinking that through and thought I would blurt it out.
Thank you,
Representative. Can't even put a question mark on it. So I won't bother by trying to ask them what they think. I won't do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Representative. I have a couple of questions, and then we'll move on. I think the first is for Mr. Garretts. So when you're training people through Team Oregon on this issue, how long are they expected to sit there if a light does not change?
Chair McEwen, the curriculum doesn't address the amount of time that they're supposed to stay there. What we suggest to the people is to notify the jurisdiction if the light's not changing. We field calls and comments. We train 11,000 people a year, so we field calls, and we're not getting calls on this since we put that information in the material that we distribute. We're not getting calls on this subject.
But again, if it never does trigger, how long are they expected to wait?
Chair McEwen, it would be like any other of us who've sat at a traffic light in a motor vehicle and the light's not working. It would be to proceed it prudently. But typically what the challenge is the lights don't all cycle the same, and they don't always have the same timing. And so the impatience of anticipating that the light's going to change or it's not going to change and you kind of run out, we don't give advice as far as how long to stay and wait for that light to change.
Thank you.
Yep.
And Ms. Joyce, I have one for you also. In the summary of your testimony, and you mentioned it when you were speaking, allowing to proceed through a red light reduces predictability and therefore may increase risk. But then also unconventional vehicles and language of the bill itself add to the confusion. Is there something we can do to make this bill better so that we eliminate that confusion? By defining these, unconventional vehicles in a different way or eliminating them from this bill? Or is there other language that we could work on to make this a better bill to ODOT's satisfaction?
Chair McEwen, I think there are ways the bills could be made better than what it is today. I think the three-wheeled vehicles piece, you can see those pictures, those don't look like a motorcycle, as what we would think of as a motorcycle. The question about the cycle of the light, I think, is a significant problem with the language of the bill. Applying the standard of a bicycle light to a motorcyclist, I think, just adds a lot of confusion as to whether now they're supposed to obey it normally, but they get this exemption because now it's created an exemption in the law. So I think there are a number of different things that could be changed. I think fundamentally, we'd still have concerns about the idea, again, of the lack of predictability and putting people a little bit more in conflict than they are today. But there are definitely ways the bill could be improved.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
I do.
Representative McClain.
Well, I do have one. The yellow light, to me, is much more dangerous than this because the stoplight, they're stopping. Okay, and they're making a conscious choice. That yellow light, I've watched people whiz, through that because it's just caution. And so to me, it seems like they're being more, that this is a safer opportunity for them. But is the yellow light something that we're going to keep seeing more and more of, that cautious turn left yellow light?
Chair McEwen and Representative McClain, yeah, I think it's fair to say we will see more of that flashing yellow light. That's a relatively new type of signal, at least in Oregon. Maybe just a couple of years ago they started, and I think we'll be seeing more of them, yes.
So you don't see that as a contradiction at all between this legislation and more of those?
Chair McEwen and Representative McClain, no, I don't. The yellow flashing arrow isn't appropriate in all places. You're not going to see it everywhere. So there are places where it's appropriate, where it helps with traffic flow to keep traffic moving, where it's safe. But there are some places where it's not appropriate. And so red light means red, and flashing yellow, it means something different.
That's my point. Red means stop. So I get that.
All right. Thank you very much for being here today. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 533. Committee, I'm going to change the order here just a little bit. House Bill 2621 is going to be held over, a little bit more work to be done on that. I'm going to move on to the work session on House Bill 3035 very quickly and open a work session on this bill. Mr. Brennan, give us a little brief update, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this bill on the 9th. It expands allowed use of flashing lights in school zones where a school parking lot is located across the street from the school on a street with posted speed limits 45 miles an hour or greater. The measure has no amendments and also has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Madam Chair. So the committee has everything it needs to take action on the bill should it desires.
Thank you. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3035 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 3035 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Pence?
Aye.
Representative King?
Aye.
Chair McKeon?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hack, would you like to carry this bill to the floor?
Thank you
very much. And I will open a work session on House Joint Memorial 5, Build America Bond Program. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, House Joint Memorial 5, we heard on the 11th. It urges Congress to reauthorize the Build America Bonds Program. Since we heard this bill, we have in our possession, four amendments, although the proponents of the amendments have broken it down to two amendments at the committee. They've asked the committee to consider two amendments. The dash two amendment replaces the reference to total amounts of bonds issued in 2014 with the amount of bonds issued in 2015 and urges Congress to authorize a federal bond program comparable to the America Fast Forward Bonds Program or Build America Bonds rather than just specifying Build America. So that's the dash twos. With the dash two, there's no fiscal and no revenue impact. The dash four is the other amendment. It adds whereas clauses related to the cost of projects related to federal mandates and regulations. With the dash four, there's also no fiscal and no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
And I would recognize Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the HJM 5-2 amendment dated 2/26 of 2015.
Vice Chair Gorsuch moves the committee adopt HJM 5-2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The dash two amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the HJM 5-4 amendment dated 3/25 of 15.
Vice Chair Gorsuch moves the committee adopt HJM 5-4 amendment. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Once again, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 5 as amended to the floor with a be adopted as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Gorsuch moves HJM 5 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Pence?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Chairman Kuhn?
Yes, aye. Thank you. The motion passes. And I believe we'll assign this, if there are no objections, to Representative Reed.
Mm-hmm. That's
that?
Great.
And I will close the work session on House Joint Memorial 5. Now we get to move on to the fun part of this session, this committee. We're very excited to have an informational hearing. And I'm not, do we have a any particular order in which we would like to call?
I think we could bring them all up together, Madam Chair.
Would you like to all join us all at once? That would be fine with us. If you need extra chairs, Nathan will help you. Status report on bicycle and pedestrian programs. Thank you all for being here today. We've been looking forward to this for some time. However you choose to proceed is perfectly fine.
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'll do a few opening remarks and
that
then
would
turn
be
it over
just
to these folks.
Great. Thank
given,
you.
Given the amount of time. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mac Lynn, Active Transportation Section Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. We've submitted some written testimony, which hopefully you have in front of you. I'll simplify my remarks so we have time for the rest of the panel to speak. The ODOT Bicycle and Pedestrian Program provides support and direction throughout ODOT to local governments and private citizens in planning, designing, and constructing bicycle and pedestrian facilities. Staff provides expertise in several areas, including developing policies, providing technical assistance, sharing information, and, of course, delivering key training. So as you are well aware, the State Highway Fund, we have a minimum 1% requirement to spend those funds on bicycle and pedestrian facilities. That requirement is for ODOT cities and counties. We also leverage our federal funding to invest in those facilities as well. Real briefly, I would mention that we're currently under the process of updating our Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Plan. So as was mentioned earlier by Representative Davis, walking and biking are certainly increasing nationwide, and we're certainly seeing that in Oregon. We know younger and older generations alike are driving less. So right now we're working with a variety of stakeholders from across the state representing cities, counties, and transportation experts in their respective fields to update that plan, which was last adopted in 1995. The plan will provide for a vision for the future, inform decision-making, and help us guide our investment strategies. It will be aligned with the goals and policies of the Oregon Transportation Plan and will serve as another tool for our integrated system planning in this state. And public comment, public review should be scheduled for this fall, I believe. So with that said, I'd just end it there with that's our program. We certainly are working very strongly with our partners at the table here today as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we have. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Bricker, and I'm the executive director of a national nonprofit organization called America Walks. As well, I'm a resident of Portland in Representative Kotek's district, and also a property owner and landlord in Representative Frederick's district, and also the CEO of a small national nonprofit organization based out of Portland with staff members around the country. So a traded sector business manager as well. So I've a longtime advocate for bicycling and walking and represented the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in the Oregon legislature, or as a lobbyist to the Oregon legislature between 2001 and 2009. And I could say that for myself and as someone who cares deeply about this issue, Oregon really is one of the best states in the nation and has a history as one of the best states in the nation as a state for bicycling and walking. I know when I moved here 20 plus years ago, I came here for that reason and for the exciting work that was done in the 1970s with the bicycle bill, the land use planning, the transit work that's happened over the last 20 plus years, and some of the innovative work that has happened since then. At the same time, I would like to say that many states are really catching up to us, if not potentially surpassing us. You may have heard about the concept of Vision Zero, for example, where many cities across the country have taken on a firm and strong commitment to reduce traffic fatalities to zero, that no child should be killed while going out to the street to catch the ball, which just happened to roll across the street, or for being able to walk into school or getting to work. While we have wonderful towns and cities across Oregon, places that people go for tourism destinations, whether it's Ashland, Jacksonville, Bend, Hood River, towns up and down the coast, places like cities like Portland, etc., many cities across the country are catching up to us. Seattle is actually recognized as the nation's most walkable city, and I know, being from Oregon, that is a problem for us here. That is something we have to reclaim. But cities like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, cities that you haven't really... that weren't really on the rise. They're on the rise. Salt Lake City has one of the most progressive transit planning going on, and many others. I'd also like to say that at the national level, there is leadership that is providing us not only the way, but cover. Transportation Secretary Fox has a document called and an initiative called Safer People, Safer Streets, and has initiated a mayor's challenge across the country that in just the last 3 weeks alone, over 150 mayors have signed up and endorsed. And as we know, many of these decisions, while you set the policy here and provide much of the funding, many decisions happen on a local level. And within that, and I'd be happy to email this to you all as a follow-up, I really didn't have time to prepare a testimony for today, I apologize. There's a whole litany of things from a road diet guide to permitting flexible transportation design, increasing eligibility for Federal Transit Administration for funding walking and biking, pedestrian safety countermeasures, and the list goes on and on of ways that the U.S. DOT, which has normally been well behind
behind the curve, and Oregon has been way ahead of, is starting to lead the way on. And so I would just like to say that there is room for improvement and a lot of opportunity, as well as cover at the national level. Another place where we're seeing this is at the Centers for Disease Control and with our health side. And we know one of the things that I want to recognize is at DOT, that they have a memorandum of understanding with health here, and that there's been a lot of collaboration, and that's one of actually, I would say Oregon is one of the leaders in that area. But on the health side, we're recognizing that walking is really the most basic and form of physical activity. As legislators, you probably recognize that how many people try and walk and talk with you in between meetings and whatnot. While you may or may not ride your bike on a daily basis here, you are walking. In fact, everyone is a pedestrian. Whether you drive to the Capitol or not, at some point you will walk, and you'll need to cross the road, and you need to have those safe conditions. Obviously, walkable communities are excellent for economic development and really fundamental to capturing the young, creative class that we have today, the Gen Xers, the Gen Yers, as well as retaining the older populations who want to be able to age in place and are consistently ranking mobility and pedestrian safety as a top issue. Let me read something from a document from Charleston, South Carolina, of all places, that was a vision of how to move their city forward, a city that has not necessarily been on the map. But bottom line for Charleston, this is from the report, moving Charleston from a car-dependent to a multimodal transit system will improve air quality, increase commuters' happiness, create a platform for greater social and economic justice, and put Charleston on the map as a city that gets it. So these are the kinds of things that cities and states around the country are saying to compete. And while when we think about economic development and transportation, we really need to think about these types of conditions that are critical for our cities. So what can we do? I'll throw out a couple of ideas, but then I know that our experts to our left will throw on there. First of all, obviously financial resources is critical for Oregon to stay competitive, to maintain and grow leadership and development and for providing transportation options, as well as safe access to transit. The other thing, I know that some of our folks will talk significantly about safety, and I know that you'll be talking about Vision Zero and whatnot, but I specifically want to hone in on speed, because speed is really one of the primary factors that we see in changing safety conditions. If someone is hit while a car is going 20 miles an hour, they have a 5% chance of dying. So if you're driving a car and someone does run out and that ball, whatever, and you hit them and you're going 20, there's only a 5% chance of that person dying. On the other hand, if you're going 40 and the same thing happens, they have a 5% chance of living. So the need for us to slow speeds down in communities across the state is critical. And this is one of the places where I think that ODOT can really make strides, as many of our state highways are going through small towns. And those are the economic centers of those small towns. And I would really urge this state, this committee, and the Department of Transportation to seriously consider a way for local communities to take those streets back and to lower those speed limits. We also know, and I guess this will be my final point on safety, is that in Oregon, 18% of the total traffic fatalities are pedestrian fatalities. But when we hear about the amount of money we spend on safety, the Oregon Transportation Safety Division has one-third of one employee working on pedestrian safety. 18% of the total traffic fatalities, but one-third of one employee are focused on pedestrian safety. So we really have a mismatch in the allocation of resources when it comes to that. And for cities of Portland, it's upwards of 30%. So I'll take a rest there. I'll move it over. But I want to say thank you for the opportunity and the willingness to hear about this issue and take the leadership to the next level. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jenna Stanky-Marmon. I'm the chair of the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee. I'm also a Southern Oregonian. I live in Medford. So in my role at OBPAC this last year, I've been on the Bike Ped Plan Policy Advisory Committee, the Connect Oregon Final Review Committee, and the STIP Stakeholder Committee. So there's been quite a breadth of experience for the chair this year, and I really appreciate the fact that we're included at the table on these committees. I just wanted to talk briefly about a few key things that I think are important in those experiences. And I always start things with a story, so bear with me. Mm-hmm. So my stepson, Clay, wanted this last summer to go to climbing camp. And climbing camp, so he's 11 years old, and climbing camp is from 9 to noon. This is not a conducive time frame for my husband and I, who both work. Fortunately, we chose our house because of its proximity to our multi-use trail, the Bear Creek Greenway. So we have easy access to the Bear Creek Greenway, and the Rogue Rock Gym, where he wanted to go to camp, happens to be right off the Bear Creek Greenway. Nearly half of all the trips on the Medford Viaduct are local. They're between the North Medford Interchange and the South Medford Interchange. So nearly 50% of the trips are local. So Clay, because he wanted to go to climbing camp, because we had to work, not only was he able to go, we didn't have to drive him back and forth. We didn't add those trips on the Medford Viaduct. He learned independence. And then the other thing about Clay is he's part of the generation that's expected to be the first generation in history to live less long than the previous. So he got healthy activity doing that. And I think that's a huge, huge thing that is really important to think of. You know, it's not just the fatalities of these kids, but it's also the fact that these kids are going to be prone to diabetes as they grow up because of our health system and because of the way that people just aren't moving around as much. So in the Connect Oregon Final Review Committee, we really appreciated that this round Bike and Ped was included. We were able to fund four fantastic projects of the 40 Connect Oregon projects, four fantastic Bike Ped projects, and approximately 6.2% or 6.2 million or 14% of the funds. The total number of applications for Bike Ped was 35, which is almost equivalent to the number that we were able to fund. A lot of people were shocked by that number. They said, oh my gosh, look at all of these Bike Ped applications. But it wasn't really surprising to us because we know that there's a high local demand for Bike Ped projects. In our experience at OBPAC, at the State Bike Ped Advisory Committee, reviewing grant proposals, we've typically seen about one out of every eight, one out of every nine projects find funding during our processes. So it was very similar. Of note, Bike Ped and TE transportation enhancements are now part of the bike or part of the STIP enhanced program. And you're seeing communities, not just your typical players, not just typically Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, but you're also seeing your Klamath Falls, you're seeing Redmond, you're seeing these applications from these local jurisdictions who really want trails, who really want the great Bike Ped projects. And what we've also noticed is that there's been this huge evolution from just a standard bike lane on a high-speed arterial where you're never going to feel safe to something protected, where you have a little bit more paint. Maybe you have traffic delineators, something that's going to get that next level of cyclists out there. You're seeing the sidewalks that are wider, that have street trees, that are make things comfortable for people to be walking out there, slow the speeds down just naturally because of the trees are act as a sort of an urban speed bump. So we're really seeing this evolution. I read this line a while ago. I think it might be in the Portland bike plan, but I added a clause: riding a bike should not require bravery. And I would add that riding a bike or crossing the street should not require bravery. And we appreciate any efforts to make Oregon Street safer for all users. When you look at that cyclist out there, you don't think, man, that guy's brave. Or you look at that woman crossing the street with her three kids in Springfield and think, man, that woman's brave. They should be safe and in turn convenient and accessible for all of our users. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you so much for being here. And I hope he had fun at climbing camp. I have a child who enjoys that activity, too. Thank you for being here.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Garrick Kransky. I'm the advocacy director with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and I want to thank you very much for dedicating time in your busy schedules to talk about bicycle and pedestrian safety. I really appreciate this opportunity. I'm sure you've heard my colleague Jonathan Manton say it before, but I'll remind you that the Bicycle Transportation Alliance exists to make bicycling safe, convenient, and accessible for everyone in Oregon. And I thought one of the things I would do to start out my comments today is just tell you a little bit about who we are as an organization and how we help pursue that mission. We work with tens of thousands of Oregonians, supporters, and members alike. And over the last 10 years, we have been delivering a program called Safe Routes to School, if it's something you've heard of. It's something we do on contract with the Oregon Department of Transportation as well as on contract with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. And it is a comprehensive bicycle and pedestrian safety education program, essentially 8 hours of in-classroom curriculum where we teach safe crossing, safe lane position, helmet fitting, visibility, and equipment requirements. And then we graduate fifth graders from that class with a two-hour community ride where they get to go out and put their new skills into practice. We're thrilled to announce that we've graduated more than 50,000 Oregon students through that program. And so that's just one of our contributions to the bike safety environment. Yeah.
Can I interrupt you just for a
Please.
Moment? Can you help geographically, how broadly are you doing this training?
Right now, in the city of Portland, it's only a handful of the schools, not all 70, currently participate in the Safe Routes to School programming that we deliver in the city of Portland. And then with the Oregon Department of Transportation, the coverage is much less extensive, and I might call on a colleague at ODOT to answer the question as to how much coverage we get in rural Oregon classrooms. I'm not positive.
I don't want to derail your testimony. You can respond later. I am going to have to excuse myself in just a minute.
Sure.
But a quick response,
yes.
Chair. I believe Vice Chair
Davis.
You ran a program in Wilsonville, with the city of Wilsonville, where I live, and we had a booth and a wonderful it was two summers ago that took place.
If you discussion. Have information you could share with the committee through Patrick, that would be great. Thank
great.
You so much.
Great.
Please continue.
Thank you. And just quickly to stay on that education front, to speak to the adult side of the equation, obviously, we can't reach everyone through that elementary school level program, but we do have a partnership with Multnomah County Circuit Court where when traffic violations are when it's possible for them to go into diversion, essentially you can take a traffic safety class instead of getting your ticket. We, as BTA staff, go to those classes and teach the bicycle and pedestrian safety component of the traffic diversion class. Whether it's good news or bad, we've graduated over 20,000 students through that program as a remedial program. But just wanted to give you a sense of our level of commitment to safety, and it is our top priority because, you know, we don't think it's appropriate to be putting our lives in the line when we just get out and ride a bike, whether it's for recreation or for transportation. And I guess I'll just touch on one of my sort of top points that you've heard a couple times already here, even though I have a fairly long laundry list of priorities of things that our organization would love to see the state of Oregon focus on when it comes to improving safety. But the first and foremost would be making a commitment to Vision Zero. Vision Zero really is the policy model that we've seen growing across the country that prioritizes human life above other transportation priorities and essentially says that we will make sacrifices in terms of speed, we will make sacrifices in terms of mobility, we will make sacrifices in terms of accessibility because nothing is more important on the roadway than our human lives, and that we can, in fact, design for human error and help put some physical protection in place between people who are walking and biking and people who are driving their cars. We think nothing of a sidewalk being elevated and separate from a roadway. That's just common practice. But yet we have all these challenges and concerns associated with people who are riding bikes on the roadway. And physical separation is one of the answers that we need to come to when it comes to our high-speed, high-traffic roads in Oregon. Providing a physically separated space for people to ride bikes is the right solution to get more people out there making that healthy choice and making sure that that choice is safe. I'll defer for a little back and forth because I'd love to hear thoughts from the committee on this subject. But again, I just really am grateful for this conversation coming up at the committee, and we do have an awful lot of priorities that we would love to be talking about.
Questions? Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. First, I would just comment, I saw a lot of that when I was in Vancouver, B.C. I'm a walker and a rider, and it was phenomenal when I saw the separations and what they do in that city, got a lot of traffic. And they've set a pretty incredible example, and both my wife and I came back, boy, there's things we could do in Oregon to make this safer. But the question I really have, you talk about the training programs in the grade school net. and I'm going to pick on university students. My bike route to work back and forth has a lot to do with the University of Oregon, and they're terrible at riding bikes. And so is there any thought given to, because in many cases these students are traveling from out of state, from a lot of different places, and they rent or buy bikes. Is there any thought given that we can do something about educating or informing college students so they're not, because I can tell you in traffic in and around the university and I'm going back as the campus housing moves further away from campus, it's getting to be a bigger problem. And so I didn't know if there's something that you might think might help address that.
I'm happy to answer that. You know, Safe Routes to School was originally conceived at the federal level in 2005, and dedicated funding for that program has actually ceased to exist. So we no longer have federal funding for Safe Routes to School, which also means we are no longer under the federal guidelines for delivery of Safe Routes to School. So if I were to think outside the box a little bit, considering a way to dramatically expand Oregon's investment in Safe Routes to School, including with college students, strikes me as the best approach to making sure that we're getting education where it's needed rather than just where we can afford it.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have a question. Thank you very much for taking the time to testify today. And I want to kind of address the tension, perhaps, as we have a finite amount of resources for infrastructure, and it's been well documented. In fact, interesting, the last couple of months, the tremendous infrastructure need we've heard talked about around the country, including in Oregon. And I think a perception, whether or not it's valid by some who only drive, that, geez, there's just more asks for more money for bike lanes and separations, and we can't even pay for the basics, and here we are asking for, you know, a gourmet meal, so to speak, of infrastructure. What's perhaps your response to that perception, to the extent it's real or not, and what's a model we can look to? I mean, we have the entire world to look at, some communities in some countries that have a much larger percentage of the population that walks and that rides to work or for recreation. What can we look to, and how do you deal with the tension I brought up?
So, Vice Chair Davis, I guess I'd go first by talking a little bit about the law. So in Oregon, we have the bike bill that requires us to have reasonable accommodations for biking and walking, so that at one level, and it does provide some of that dedicated funding. The second is accessibility for all users, specifically ADA. So while we have some of those infrastructure that certainly we have great needs, we also have a responsibility to address those needs. So to the first part of your question.
Vice Chair Davis. I think one of the most compelling arguments I've heard in that sort of pushback is using the city of Portland as an example where 10% of the traffic over the bridges every morning is bikes.
Right.
And if you imagine all of those people on bikes driving cars in their each individual cars, clearly those bridges would have technically failed from a capacity standpoint, vehicular capacity standpoint. So I think looking at a transportation system is how to best move people and move freight, and step away from, oh, well, that's taking away from cars, is the best way to answer that question. And I'll turn to Garrick for some examples and some more ideas.
Well, I think it bears mentioning in this context, and obviously working at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, I feel that tension a lot. We're always out looking for increases in transportation funding, and that's for safe and accessible bike facilities. So to that question, I would say that we currently spend about $4.3 billion every 2 years at the Oregon Department of Transportation. That's an awful lot of money, and I think there are a great many opportunities to reallocate portions of those funding for new safe facilities. Frankly, one of the realities of, you know, our own state mandated by this body's recommendations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from all sources is that in Oregon, about 40% of all global warming pollution comes from cars and trucks. So tailpipe emissions are one of our top targets if we're going to be able to
reduce carbon emissions. And this isn't ancillary stuff anymore. This isn't some benefit that a few people can pursue. This is a core tenet of our transportation system that is currently unsafe, and the network is incomplete, and the funding allocations aren't supporting the new types of infrastructure that are going to be required if we actually want to motivate mothers to get out and ride to school with their children in a small box in front of the bike, or in on small bikes behind their mother as they're headed from home to school to drop off the children and then go to work. That's perfectly normal in many places in the world, and it's not necessarily safe here. It's because of the lack of investment. So we should be thinking about reallocating some of those dollars.
Vice Chair, if I may, one other point, or maybe one or two. First, approximately 30% of the people in our state don't have a driver's license or don't drive. So the fact of trying to provide transportation options for everyone.
What was that percentage again?
30%.
And I apologize. We are at the end of the committee, so folks who have to leave, feel free to.
Yeah. So I think that's a critical issue. And for the population, 100% of the people use the sidewalks and the walkways, while maybe 70% of the people are actually operating vehicles. Ironically, most of the sidewalks in the state are not covered by governments in the sense of maintenance and repair. So, for example, the city of Portland, landowners are required to maintain and repair. You can imagine as a landowner how wonderful it is to receive a $10,000 bill in the mail to say your sidewalk is not repaired, and so the city of Portland is not currently prioritize doing that anymore. And there are many cities around the country that are looking towards bringing that back into their transportation portfolio and actually prioritizing that. As you can imagine, many cities also and states are using sales tax as a way to pay for transportation investments. It is important to note, and I don't have the exact percentage, but it would be a good thing for to look at, that typically about 60%, what I remember, of total transportation dollars in Oregon are gas tax generated, and the rest of them are generated through property taxes and other types of taxes. And so there is a huge number percentage of the pie. I don't know the exact percentage of that. That's an old number that I have in my head. But there's a large percentage of the taxes of the total transportation dollars, not just ODOT, but happening at the local level, that is comes from different types of property taxes.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much for a great committee. And with that, do we have more questions?
No. No. I did have one. I find great, even though we're at the end of the committee.
We are.
You can gavel me down if you like. Well, I'm just thinking that everything you're suggesting is good. I mean, getting people out exercising, that's great. Bicycling, that's great. I think though that we're all enjoying kind of the last vestiges of an old system. That would be gasoline and diesel, and all of the tax that's paid for all the good things that people bicycle and walk on. Those systems are failing, and they're going to be replaced with electric cars and other things. And I think the argument about global warming is going to go out the window for you and for many others, and the issue is going to be far more difficult to deal with. So I like your movement over toward sales tax as a concept of how we're going to get people to pay for that which they use. If we ever get back to a transportation discussion around this place, the bicycles will be on the tax table, and they will get to start paying just like everybody else. And that's going to be part of the future regardless. I just thought I would mention that because I think it's something that's important to be discussed and on the table. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you very much for testifying today. And with that, we are adjourned. And thank you very much for testifying today. And with that, we are adjourned.